Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Well, I think I'm doing okay, Justin.
There's been an update in the news on Jeffrey Epstein. He's been now indicted on multiple counts of sex trafficking with minors. Also, since this recording, Jeffrey Epstein has taken his own life behind bars. I think for obvious reasons, being he was a multimillionaire or a billionaire who is facing life in prison. This has kind of sparked or reignited the debate over Pizzagate and his ties to different politicians and individuals. Some claim this is proof that the conspiracy was real. But this week, Elaine Maxwell, who was running a non-for-profit organization, shut down the organization abruptly and is now being tied to Epstein. And what I find a little interesting is she was never mentioned in the conspiracy. She was never named as a co-conspirator. She was never even a blip on the radar. And it just goes to show how wrong the conspiracy theorists are when they can't even get the players right.
If it's a true conspiracy, we don't know how many players there are to begin with.
Yeah, but if they have it all figured out like they say they do on YouTube, then why wasn't she named? Why are other people named?
Right, I get it. The rush to judgment. In other words, wait, there could be a conspiracy here. Let's keep investigating. But instead it's, oh, we know everything now. This guy was doing this and he had these people with him and probably started naming a bunch of celebrities. But is it really all celebrities? I mean, one thing I would like to clear up, we had a few people, not too many, a few people after our Pizzagate episode come at us a bit and say, really? You don't believe in sex trafficking? Oh, no, it's real. And we've already talked about it in the past on some episodes, and maybe those have been forgotten. But no, sex trafficking happens. The thing here is that whenever there's a new conspiracy theory coming up, it seems like people are quick to throw celebrities under the bus and say, oh, they're involved, they're doing this. We have no idea. Let's get the facts first. And then, sure, I'm on board if they get some good evidence.
I mean, they gave him a slap on the wrist already for this. We know he's guilty.
And, well, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like we stated that clearly. But what we don't believe is that there are tunnels running underground from pizza joints where they're trafficking children. It's the McMartin school trials all over again.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. Looking for a fun and relaxing way to unwind? Download Two Dots, the free puzzle game with over 5,000 unique levels. Connect dots to solve colorful puzzles and collect rewards. With different gameplay modes like scavenger hunt and arcade, there's always a new adventure. Don't want a game alone? Connect and engage with the larger Two Dots community to match up your skills. If you're looking for the perfect game to help you relax but also keep you engaged, download Two Dots for free on Android and iOS.
Tonight's case is kind of a doozy. Prominent surgeon, his wife is killed, and they live in a very nice part of town, so she is shot through a window. And all of you have already figured out the case.
But, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Because who did it?
Yeah.
The husband did it.
Yeah.
That's the saying.
So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Well, tonight we're talking about Dr. Richard Illes and the murder of his wife, Miriam. In 1999, Miriam Illes was 47 years old, and Dr. Richard Illes was 45 years old. Let's talk a bit about Richard. He had his residency at St. Louis Medical Center. He met Miriam in 1989. Back then, she was Miriam Zambi. She worked as a surgical assistant, but her actual title was perfusionist. And I didn't know anything about what a perfusionist was, but I looked it up. And I've had heart surgery before. She's responsible for the heart-lung machine, which ensures that patients undergoing heart surgery maintain their respiratory and circulatory functions. Pretty important, I'd say. They got married in 1991 and continued to work together at the hospital. They eventually had a son named Richie, and then they moved to Pennsylvania, and they worked there together as well. They moved into this big mansion. It was on a hill. They were probably one of, if not the wealthiest people in their community of Williamsport, Pennsylvania. It's known for its Little League World Series. I've seen places where they say, and that's it. But I've heard it's a great place to raise your family. So even though it's not a famous town, it's well regarded. Miriam's been described as dynamic and exuberant, down to earth. Again, they're very wealthy, but Miriam lived humbly for the most part and shopped at the dollar store to save money. But of course, I hear that many wealthy people find ways to save money, and that's why they're wealthy. When Richie turned 2 years old, Miriam decided to just stay at home and be a mom, take care of the house. And I think it was really because Richie was her life. She loved her little boy. Her husband has also said she was an excellent mom. Around this time, she's at home. She's raising little Richie. Her husband, Dr. Richard Illes, is off at work being a surgeon. He's working really long hours. It's said, because Miriam has friends, they say she's saying that her husband wants her to have food on the table at a certain time. The house needs to be cleaner. You name it. Just very demanding. And then they seem to be growing apart, where she's spending her evenings alone and her husband's not there. It's not looking good. Late in 1998, Miriam hired a divorce attorney. Now, she doesn't like divorce, but I think she saw the writing on the wall and thought, this is either going to fix it or fix it. You know, either he's going to get his stuff straightened out and we'll get back together, or we'll stay separated and we'll go through with the divorce. She thought one of the reasons he wasn't so involved anymore is because he was seeing another woman.
Possibly multiple women, but definitely one other at this time.
Yeah, and it was discovered that he had an assistant named Catherine Sawyer. According to Catherine, she and the doctor didn't start seeing each other until after the separation, but whenever it happened, he had a mistress. So Miriam moved out of the mansion, and she took Richie with her. The lawyers are meeting. They're trying to hash out this upcoming divorce. Richie's living with his mother during the week and then staying with his dad on the weekends. The numbers, though, what's more dangerous than this? The doctor is looking at maybe having to pay Miriam $13,000 a month in child support. And of course, he is saying his income is $600,000, and his wife is saying, no, he makes over $1 million a year.
That's a recipe for disaster because, yes, his infidelity is not great. His lack of parenting is the whole reason why she's getting a divorce in the first place. But let me just put it this way. If you are ever going through a divorce process, if you don't have to hire lawyers, don't do it. If you're forcing somebody to pay $13,000 a month, and this is back in the late 90s, I'm just saying that when people say it'd be cheaper to kill him, this is where that saying comes from. This is his rhetoric is, well, it'd be cheaper just to kill her than to pay $13,000 a month. I know that legally and fairly, this is what she's asking for, or at least her lawyers are asking for, because they're going to take a cut. That's motive right there, and I don't like it, but that's the biggest motive ever, besides life insurance policies that are $1 million.
January 15th, 1999, Miriam was on the phone with Richard's sisters, Romaine and Sue. They were talking about how Richard's girlfriend wasn't going to be around for a few days, and Miriam was hoping that she could get Richard to try and patch up the relationship, patch up the marriage. I think the sisters were very supportive. So they were talking about how Richie was going to be with his dad while he was visiting his sister. She lived 3 hours south of where Miriam and Richard had lived. The conversation ended about 10:47, but it ended abruptly. And this is kind of a scary moment because, you know, on one hand, you can say, well, maybe it's the weather. Maybe a storm happened. It knocked out the connection. But then it might be something else, too.
Phone cuts off.
Now, there was a storm at the time. You'd think, well, maybe it just got interrupted. It was a cordless phone.
Yeah, and maybe a branch hit a telephone line outside. A lot of things could have happened. But it was exactly at 10:47.
Richard's sister called back, but she couldn't reach Miriam. The next day, Miriam didn't show up to teach Sunday school, and some of the people who were concerned for her went together to go over to her house to check on her. They looked in the kitchen window, and they were horrified by what they saw. They knew they saw Miriam on the floor.
Face down, her back obviously was to the window, and she had fallen forward.
Because she didn't show up, they're thinking, she's dead.
Yeah. At this point, I'm not sure if they noticed the bullet hole in the window or if they just thought she'd collapsed. But regardless, they know something's wrong, so they call law enforcement.
Well, the police show up and they find Miriam. I think it's obvious to them that she's been shot. Within a few hours, Richard arrived to drop off Richie. Police officers there met him in the driveway. Richie's in the car. Richard's outside the car. The police are asking him questions. They inform him that Miriam is dead. He gets emotional. He has a real reaction, but he also starts asking them questions like, well, how was she killed? What evidence did you find? which these police officers are like, we get the how did she die, but what evidence did you find? At least for them, that was a very odd question.
Immediately after they find the body and talk to him, he's on their radar.
They search all around the house. What they find is a homemade rifle silencer, and there were three hairs inside of it. There were footprints that they estimated to be a size 14 Nike tennis shoe. They also found a cigarette butt that was about 70 feet from the home.
It was right next to a tree. The kitchen window was facing the tree. So they assume that is where the shooter had set up and fired his shot, smoked a cigarette, tossed it to the ground. It gave him cover and was a clear view of the kitchen.
One of Miriam's friends, when she was interviewed, even said that when she had been over, I don't know if it was months earlier, but she said Miriam even pulled her aside away from the window at one point and just said, yeah, let's not talk in front of the windows. And so she wondered if Miriam knew that she was a target or something.
I'm not sure if she would have known somebody was going to shoot at her, or if she didn't want anyone seeing her talking to this person. Who knows? But it is weird that she would make this comment of stay away from the windows. And then she ends up getting shot and killed through the kitchen window.
So Dr. Richard Illis is a suspect in his wife's murder, but he has an alibi, Justin.
Yeah, he was traveling, right?
Richard had been visiting his sister with his son, Richie. So at the time Miriam was killed, he was actually traveling back. So he was on the road. How could he have been involved if he's traveling when she is shot and killed? He even has evidence that he was at a McDonald's to confirm that he was somewhere else. And they also ended up staying at a hotel near Harrisburg that night because of bad road conditions.
Yeah, it was probably that storm that was happening.
But investigators, you know, they take his alibi and they test it out. They actually make the trip themselves and time how long it takes to get from point A to point B, given where he says he was and the time of the murder. They don't get the same times that he does. So they're once again suspicious of him, even though it does look like he was traveling at the time.
Yeah. He says he was on his way back, and they're kind of thinking, well, maybe this all went down before. So that's their discrepancy.
A few days after the murder, Richard is now living with his girlfriend. Her name is Catherine, and in his son. His home was supposedly the scene of a break-in. The garage was opened, lights were turned on, and a toy of Richie's was moved.
That's a break-in?
I know. When they said a break-in, I was waiting to hear about broken glass, things missing. But literally, the garage door is up, some lights are turned on, and a toy is moved.
Sure, you've left your garage door open a few times and lights have been on and maybe you forgot or maybe you didn't know. That doesn't sound like a break-in to me, but
Richard, of course, maintains it was broken into. His girlfriend maintains that it was broken into. So you have two people saying that. Catherine said that, yes, there was an alarm system on Richard's house, but Richard wasn't going to pay to maintain the monitoring on it because he was planning to move. So there was no alarm sent when the garage was broken into, even though it had an alarm system.
How convenient.
Okay, so Dr. Illis, he's a suspect. Any way you cut this, because his alibi isn't considered solid, even though it seems to be a decent alibi. So what else could this be? Who else could have murdered Miriam?
Well, they don't have a murder weapon, and the doctor has high-end lawyers. So yeah, they have to focus on other leads and other angles, because right now, the doctor one, not going anywhere.
Yeah, I think it's, let's put it in our back pocket. And as we say all the time, you need to look at more than one angle.
So the first angle they look at is Miriam and her teaching, which is kind of weird. But hey, parents, I guess, are fanatical about how their children are taught in school, right?
Right. Well, Miriam was a Sunday school teacher. She was Catholic, but to an outsider, she's Lebanese. She's born in America, but she's of Lebanese descent. So for someone who just looks at her, they might think she's an Arab.
That's at least the police officer's theory or hypothesis in what they're going on. They deduce that some parents might not like her teaching their children. Maybe it's some hillbilly guy out in the woods who doesn't want his child being brainwashed.
Yeah, maybe there's a racist out there that doesn't want someone from over there to come over here and teach their children. But this doesn't really go anywhere.
I mean, it's a far-fetched sort of idea to me. If she had a problem child in class and a possible altercation with some parents, sure. But this is just law enforcement conjuring up an idea. Yeah, it didn't go anywhere because they're just trying to throw stuff at a wall and see what sticks.
And I don't think this one's sticking very well. The other thing is, when they interview numerous people, they all say the same thing, which is Miriam had a lot of friends. She was very friendly. She was kind to people, and they couldn't think of anyone who would want to harm her. So then they look at where she worked. She used to work with her husband, and they knew of a person named Dr. N.J. Zama, because maybe, this is just speculation, but maybe Enche wanted to be with Miriam. Maybe she turned him down, and then Enche worried that she would tell her husband, and then Enche's position at the hospital would be in trouble. So maybe he would have to silence her.
Well, there is speculation about this, but no solid evidence. They were talking about, well, you know, maybe he called her to apologize for some pass he made, but there's no physical evidence showing any of this. It's just, again, law enforcement coming up with things, and they actually bring him in to interview, and it doesn't go anywhere.
We're going to get into some more evidence that might show us how they got there, at least in terms of thinking about it.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
We're going to get into some more evidence that might show us how they got there, at least in terms of thinking about it. A letter arrived at Richard's attorney's office that was postmarked 4 days after the search at the house. So this letter was postmarked January 16th, 1999. The writer, who wrote in pencil in block lettering, claimed to be the true murderer of Miriam and said she died because she was racist. It was signed Soldier of God, Soldier of Equality, Soldier of Death. This is just an excerpt from this letter, but it said, "I shot Miriam. The Lord told me to harvest the wicked racist ones of this town. I even made it look like Dr. Illis did it, but the night I did it, the Lord was angry because he did not tell me to harm him. I even put the gun where they would it," and that's been redacted, "and think it was his. I undid much of it, but couldn't undo it all. I got the gun back and wrote a letter to the editor of the Sun Gazette that weekend explaining that I was ordered to do God's work and that he should print the letter as a warning to all. He did not." Now, you're wondering how Dr. Zama figures in this. On May 4th, 1999, a second letter came where the writer spoke more about himself. Here's an excerpt. "It would have demonstrated that Dr. Illis could not have been the killer of his evil wife. The stupid authorities are not interested in the truth at this point. They have been fooled by my superior intellect. I speak five languages. The paper said they found wire in Dr. Illis's trash that matched what I used in the silencer. I had free access to his home while he was on vacation and used many of his supplies to fabricate my equipment. Please make the newspaper print my original letter, postmarked January 16th, 1999. It will clear up many misconceptions." Because of the number of languages that this letter writer claims to speak, they're looking at Dr. Zama because Dr. Zama speaks two or three languages.
He's highly educated.
I'm not going to go through his education, but he finished at Harvard. In 2011, he was named one of the top 25 heart surgeons in America.
I mean, all these guys are highly educated, but he's multilingual. So being smart and multilingual is what put him in the crosshairs.
They look into Dr. Enche Zama. They talk to him. They ask him questions about where he was at the time of the murder. He says that he was out with friends, and he's willing to give them all the names of these people. His alibi checks out. And not only that, but Dr. Zama has an ironclad reputation. There is nothing to support that he would have done this. You know, another thing, I looked into Dr. Zama, and there's a video where he talks about the day that he decided to become a doctor. And of course, he's a heart and thoracic surgeon these days. He became a doctor because as a young boy, he watched his mother die during childbirth. There was no doctor around to save her. No one was qualified or even knew what to do when she was dying.
So this is traumatic and gave him a mission in life.
And he decided that he wanted to save lives, so he became a doctor. This is not the kind of guy who's going to assassinate a woman while she's in her kitchen talking on the phone. It just doesn't make any sense. The other evidence they had found at the home, I need to bring this up now because as we go through the story, it's going to add up to something. They also find materials that could have been used to make a silencer. They also find inside of Richard's home a book titled They Wrote Their Own Sentences, which is an FBI handwriting analysis book. This was on his nightstand.
Now, this book talks about how to, I guess, obfuscate your writing style using block lettering and other techniques. What was that letter that the police received saying, "I'm so smart and I'm framing the doctor"?
Right. It was written in block letters with a pencil because they can actually figure out the source of ink. So they can sort of track what kind of pen was it, etc. But with a pencil, it's not that easy.
Oh, I mean, the number two is the most popular writing utensil out there. At least it was back in 99. This is very circumstantial, but they get a letter and they find a book that literally dictates how this letter was written. Got it.
The cigarette butt and the hair were sent for DNA analysis. Also along with that was a sample of Richard's DNA. The cigarette and the hairs were not from the same person, And none of these samples could be matched to Richard.
Most people are probably screaming at their speakers right now. He hired somebody to do it, right?
But of all the evidence they sent in, none of them were from the same person. So we're talking about five separate DNA samples, I think.
So you have the cigarette butt, you have the letter, you have the shoe prints that aren't the size he wears, and then they find the hairs and the DNA, and none of that matches.
But investigators are suspicious. They're thinking, how do we have this many different profiles?
Because at that point, you have to assume the cigarette butt had nothing to do with the murder. It wasn't smoked by the murderer. The letter and other things, if you accept that that was written by the murderer, were. So, yeah, you don't have multiple people involved here. You have one. So it doesn't make sense.
In July of 1999, Dr. Richard Illis and Catherine Sawyer get married. The police at that point think they know who killed Miriam. They think that Richard shot his wife because he knows how to use a rifle. Isn't that right, Justin?
Oh, yeah.
As a boy, he spent a lot of time with Uncle Joe, and Uncle Joe showed him how to use a rifle, how to shoot deer, and even gave him weapons.
Yeah, and his father owned guns, too. There is a weird backstory about Uncle Joe. It's possible he's his biological father, but regardless, he does gift Dr. Ellis a gun, a rifle. The rifle was passed down from grandfather to Uncle Joe down onto Dr. Ellis. They find pictures, photographs of this rifle, so they know it exists. But again, they don't have a murder weapon, so they're wondering what happened here.
In the summer of 1999, a man was walking about 40 feet from one of the roads Richard said he drove on the night Miriam died. He tripped over what he thought was just a piece of wood, but what it turned out to be was a rifle with a scope.
Discarded in this wooded area.
The gun was a loaded Savage 23D rifle with a sawed-off barrel and stock. The serial number, which, you know, if you can find the serial number, you can track the weapon. Well, it was gone.
It was drilled out, not filed off, but actually drilled through, which somebody was really trying to hide the identity of this rifle. What I don't get is if you're going to take the time to drill through the serial number, why don't you just disable the entire thing, melt it down, crush it, throw it in the bottom of a lake? I don't know, but it's discarded in this area, and it is found.
Hunters seem to find a lot of things. That gun had been discontinued in 1949. But again, they find a picture of Richard's late grandfather holding a rifle that looks just like that weapon. So what are the odds? They're thinking, he had access to it. Why would someone drill the serial number off and throw it out in the woods like that?
And it's kind of rare rifle. It's not like an AR-15 or an AK or anything like that, where sort of a dime a dozen. This is a very specific historic rifle. What are the odds?
The other connection they have is because Uncle Joe had many of the grandfather's things and Richard was the executor of Joe's estate. Well, whether he was given the rifle or whether, because he was the executor of the estate, he could just get access to it. Well, there are numerous ways of how he could have come into possession of this weapon. It's a weapon that there are no records for other than this photograph.
So we have a rifle that we knew he owned at some point. It was in the photographs, found out in the woods where he says he was, and the serial number has been drilled out, and we haven't found the murder weapon for this shooting.
Yeah, the rifle was found 40 feet from where he would have driven by.
And then we have books on how to write a letter and not give yourself away. And there's letters being written to the police.
So it's not just the investigators who are looking at Richard and thinking, you killed your wife. The people who used to probably at least respect Richard, well, a lot of them no longer want anything to do with him, and he's losing patience and he's feeling the pressure. So,
and when you say patience, you mean people that are seeing him. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there are a lot of people are looking at him and thinking, you murdered your wife. So Richard, Catherine, and Richie moved to Laredo, Texas. This is in November of 2000. The investigators are worried that because of the pressure and because he really feels like there's going to be an arrest and it's going to be him, that Dr. Richard Illis might just make a break for it. He might just leave the country.
Flight risk.
So they're keeping close tabs on Dr. Illis.
But he's continuing to work, doing heart surgeries, and technically saving lives all across the nation.
Richard's saying, if I was going to leave, I'd have been gone already. I'd be in some Mexican villa. He said, I don't want to give anyone any greater impression that I'm guilty. I'm just trying to live my life. And in 2001, Richard left Texas and moved to Liberty Lake, Washington, near Spokane, and applied to be a heart surgeon there. The administrator there received a packet stuffed with newspaper articles and a letter warning her not to allow Richard to work there. And so she didn't. Because I think the story here was, is this guy probably murdered his wife. I don't think you should pay him. Don't hire him.
Yeah. His reputation precedes him.
April of 2002, Catherine divorced Richard. He became a cosmetic surgeon and opened Valley Cosmetic Surgery Center. There was an article about him in a Spokane newspaper. The reporter received a packet of newspaper clippings and a letter, much like the administrator who turned down Richard from a prior job. I guess the going theory was is that Miriam's family might have been trying to keep tabs on where Richard was going and wanted to make his life difficult.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we see people do this for way less.
December 17th, 2002, the district attorney finally was ready to take action. They were just looking at all the circumstantial evidence and decided, we're going to charge Dr. Richard Illis for the murder of his wife.
They figure with the discovery of the rifle, now they can say we have a murder weapon that belonged to him. They start tying things together.
And not too far from where they found the rifle, they also found a pair of size 14 shoes, and there were hairs on the shoes. So there was a hair on one of the letters and a couple of hairs on the shoes.
And then the DNA on the cigarette butt. And none of it matches the doctor.
Two investigators from Pennsylvania flew out to Washington. They had originally planned to arrest Richard at his practice, but I guess they found out that he had heard that they were on the way because he'd gotten in his car and drove to the freeway. He went towards downtown Spokane when he was pulled over and police were able to arrest him.
They didn't want to do it at his house, though, because they knew he had guns. They were a little afraid that he might try to shoot his way out of this situation. So they thought at work would be the safest place, and he tried to evade them.
New Year's Day, 2003, he's extradited from Spokane, from Washington, back to Pennsylvania. Virginia Butler, Miriam's sister, was granted custody of 9-year-old Richie the day after Richard's arrest, and Richie went to live with her and her husband in Florida. Richard's attorney said, this isn't right, and he petitioned to have Richie cared for by a woman who was Richard's new girlfriend, saying that his arrest was not enough cause for him to lose custody of his son. What do you think about that, Justin?
When you're arrested for the murder of your wife, I'm assuming that that is enough cause, at least to put the child somewhere safe until you're exonerated. I think of that wonderful documentary called Dear Zachary. If you haven't watched it, have a box of tissues out and an anger management course set up, because this is a possibility when children aren't protected in a situation like this.
The court denied that motion on December 31st of that year and stated that the notoriety of the case in both Pennsylvania and Spokane was enough reason to send Richie to Florida. Again, the child, their safety needs to come first. Too bad for Richard. Richard's going on trial. It's not looking good for him. I think you already know that. This is a very circumstantial case, but it's a heavy circumstantial case. In other words, they don't have a video of him committing the murder.
And the physical evidence is not matching up with him. But you have a woman that's shot through a window in a very upscale neighborhood. Who does that? Well, the only person with a motive. Duh.
None of the evidence matched up because, as the police would say, it was planted by the killer.
Yeah. You have this idea that the cigarette butt, these shoes, this rifle, these hairs were put there. And he's a doctor. He has access to these things. Then you think of the letters trying to form the investigation, trying to drive the investigation away from him.
Another thing that happened was a search of Richard's Spokane home turned up a manuscript on his computer that was titled Heart Shot, Murder of the Doctor's Wife. The names were all the same as in Miriam's case, and there was a full detailed account of his wife's death from the killer's perspective. Now, when Richard had to talk about this, he said that the manuscript was just a way for him to deal with her death. The investigators, the DA, no one was buying that. The trial began in January of 2004, which is quite a long ways from when the murder actually occurred.
Yeah, this is 5 years later, and he was walking around free for at least three or four of those.
The prosecution was arguing that Richard's motive was to kill his wife because the divorce was costly. He didn't want to give her $13,000 a month. I think of all the murders, when you look back, any time it has to do with alimony, the husband just doesn't want to pay it. It's cheaper to kill her. And it's a scary thing that you brought it up as soon as we were talking about it in the beginning. There's your motive right there. And it doesn't take that much to get a jury to think along those lines and say, yeah, he's wealthy, but he doesn't want to give that all to this woman he doesn't like anymore.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
The defense was saying, hey, none of this evidence matches up with Richard. What case do they have here? He has plenty of money. He wears a shoe size of 9.5. How is he wearing a size 14? None of the hairs match. The cigarette butt DNA doesn't match him. The hairs don't match him. What do they have here? They just have their speculation. Catherine, Richard's third wife, who moved in with him after Miriam's death, she testified at the trial. And I think she had a big impact. She said that Richard had drugged his son to help him cope with the loss of his mother. Richie couldn't sleep. But investigators had speculated that Richie must have been drugged because when they finally talked with him, he didn't have anything to tell them. So how is Dr. Illis going to drive his son back to the house and shoot his wife and Richie not know about it?
Technically, his son should have been his most solid alibi reference, but he wasn't. Now, given they didn't ask his son They didn't interview the son till much, much later. So he didn't have many things to say, but he has a whole gap in his memory here. You would think that he would have some recollection of the week that his mother was murdered.
Catherine was asked what kind of drugs was the doctor giving to Richie, and she said she didn't know. She said the only thing she knew were that they were a controlled substance. So there's a lot of speculation out there. If Richie was given drugs, what was he given? His dad was a doctor. He had access to medicines. Was Richie given Valium? Was he given Darvocet? Was he given Versed? I don't think we'll ever know, but how else can you explain why Richie doesn't remember going back home or doesn't really remember what happened that weekend? He knows he was on a trip with his dad, but he doesn't really have any other information. I think that's why people believe that Richie was drugged. Catherine also testified that Dr. Illis had obtained a list of countries without extradition treaties with the U.S. from an attorney 6 months after Miriam was murdered. And of course, the doctor has always maintained, I'm not running anywhere. But this is a list that's been verified that he got through testimony.
This will come into a little bit of play later when we talk about the outcome of this case.
Well, this trial lasted for 5 weeks. The jury deliberated for 2.5 days. The second day, the jury told the judge they were deadlocked. They couldn't come to a decision. And the judge said, just hang in there. The next day, February 20th, 2004, they did arrive at a decision.
They came up with guilty.
Guilty of first-degree murder. There's no death sentence here, but the doctor probably isn't too happy about this. And I mean, I wonder if he would have preferred death.
Well, he tried to take his own life. I guess he had a pen or something that he took apart and cut into himself with, because he's been living this high life. It's very privileged life. And now he's going to spend the rest of his life behind bars? No.
Yeah, he attempted to take his life about a week after the trial. The jury was polled after their decision. One juror hesitated, then mumbled a response. They had to be asked again, like, what did you say? And they said guilty. So the defense was trying to say maybe that juror didn't really believe in their decision, and so maybe they were coerced. But the prosecution said, no, this juror was just nervous. One juror also said that she was kind of hung up on whether Richard was really the owner of that rifle. When she asked for the evidence, they were able to show her the rifle in the picture, who the person in the picture was, how it all fit together with Richard. And I think she was able to see how he could have come into possession of that rifle.
The defense is arguing that that's not even the same rifle. The one that's found out in the woods is completely different than the one in the picture. Totally different, and there's no connection there. Keep that in mind.
The jury has to make a decision. Miriam was murdered. Someone did it. And with all of this, what I call heavy circumstantial evidence, I think they thought there's nothing else that makes more sense than her husband murdered her. He had all the motive and he had the opportunity. It certainly seemed like he did his best to point the finger elsewhere, but it just didn't work. Miriam's family gave a statement after the verdict was read. It was, "This was a tragic thing here, and we don't feel there are any winners. But we are glad to finally get to this point, to have a resolution and justice."
So, of course, Richard is going to appeal this verdict, and he's going to appeal on several fronts. One, there was no change of venue because it was a very high-profile case, but that just didn't work out. He also is appealing that his counsel was ineffective based on many things.
Well, we know why the counsel was ineffective, because he was found guilty.
Oh, yeah. That's always the first reason. But he claims that they didn't bring up enough witnesses for him, like his own character references. Yet some of the witnesses that they did bring up for him testified against him. So the judge sort of shoots down that appeal, or that point of the appeal, because he's like, well, you did have people take the stand, but it just didn't work out in your favor.
Right. Like Catherine, his third wife, when she was testifying, she talked about some of the things that Dr. Ellis had said to her. Very cruel things, very demeaning things. And she said, not only did he say that stuff to me, but he also said, you're blankety blank, just like Miriam was.
He also says that he wasn't able to testify in his defense. Well, your counsel probably told you not to take the stand, and you agreed. So you can't say, oh, well, I should have been able to, when you're the one that didn't agree in the first place, right?
Well, and this is where I think back and I think, okay, so if Richard murdered his wife, which I think we all know he did, if he murdered his wife and tried to get away with it by planting evidence and writing these fake letters, how is he going to help himself by getting on the stand and talking?
Well, and that's where the prosecutor would have been like, well, you have this book called How to Hide Your Assets and Disappear, and another one that's called They Write Their Own Sentences. How do you explain that, Richard? And he'd be sitting there on the stand going, duh. He argues that he has a friend named Stephen A. Smith who says that he would have testified that he had discarded that rifle in the woods prior to the murder. It couldn't have been used in the murder. But he's saying he was in possession of the rifle and discarded it before the murder. Remember, the defense said, this is not the rifle that was used in the murder. Kinda doesn't work out, right? Is it the rifle or is it not the rifle? And then you have this guy saying he discarded it. He's not credible. They had talked to him in the initial trial. He became combative and argumentative with the counsel and the judge. A main thing of his appeal is this guy that says he had possession of the rifle, but it kind of goes against their whole theory of this wasn't the rifle that was used. So that really, I don't know. They're throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks, and that's what they come up with. They also brought up the flight risk for the doctor and denying him bail or setting it very high. Yet he had planned to go to Mexico or other countries that didn't have extradition. So again, it's just a one more point of the appeal that just didn't work out too well in his favor. There's more little details of the appeal, but those are the main points that I wanted to cover real quick. And they were all shot down.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about Dr. Ellis getting out.
When I think about this, I think, what if he had gotten rid of the rifle properly? What if he had discarded those shoes properly? What if he had never written those letters? Well, all of a sudden, they might not have had much to go on to convict him. But his own arrogance? What do you think, Aaron?
All right, it's greed and arrogance. You can look at his educational background and you can say, this guy is brilliant, but there is no person who's brilliant at everything. You're brilliant in a field. If you put Justin and I out on a road trip, Justin's going to be good at finding out where to go instinctively. He'll know that. I'll have the things I'm good at, but this doctor tried to do everything. He's trying to say, I can be a surgeon, I can be a killer, and I can totally evade capture by pointing the finger at possibly a colleague or someone not named Dr. Ellis. But the problem is, he thought he was so smart, thought he could outsmart the cops, and then he just ended up creating, in our minds, more evidence for them to look at, and it became more circumstantial evidence.
He got himself caught, really. That's how this goes. I don't care how smart he was. I don't care how many lives he saved with his surgeries. He got in his own way. There's a recent update in 2015. Richard filed a lawsuit in prison claiming he was deprived of food. He represented himself and claimed that he was denied 46 meals. He lost 20 pounds. They moved him temporarily to Camp Hill. He made his court appearances. The prison has a policy that requires that once mealtime is announced, all the inmates must be properly dressed, have their beds neatly made, their cell light on, and be standing at the door. Richard claims that his medications for chronic back pain were reduced, making it impossible for him to move quickly enough to comply with all these standards. He says that the staff was indifferent to his health, and he filed this complaint about the situation.
Yeah, this prison, Camp Hill, where he was at, where he says he was denied all these meals, it was just so he could be at these court appearances. But I think, honestly, as someone from the outside looking in, this is just Richard pouting. This is him having a rough time and complaining about it and trying to gain sympathy, I think. Again, he had everything and lost it all. He gambled it all and lost it all.
I've talked to a lot of inmates, and prison food is horrible. Most of the time, you don't want to eat it. I don't know if this is him not being fed or him refusing to eat, whatever it is, but I know prison conditions are downright horrible in a lot of places, but this does seem a little petty.
Well, in January 2016, a jury found that Richard was not denied food while at Camp Hill. I don't think, despite his trying, that anybody's ready to give him any sympathy. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.